Thank you very much. Our commentator today, we are fortunate to have Wendy Lower, John K. Roth Professor of History at Claremont McKenna College. She's also director of the McGrubliang Center for Human Rights at Claremont McKenna. She was for many years at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum and now is on its academic advisory board. She's the author of a number of important studies, a book on the Holocaust in Ukraine, and most recently, Hitler's Furies, German Women in the Nazi Killing Fields. It came out in 2013 and was a National Book Award finalist. Nice to see you, Wendy.
I'm going to keep my comments brief so that we have time for questions. I'm just looking at my watch here. So I just want to make a couple of points. Thank you very much, Norman, for that introduction. And thank you very much for including me in the conference. And I'm going to kind of go through a couple, you know, through the papers, as it were, and start with Ben Mathey's, the terrific presentations. I learned a lot. It's exciting to see the research that's going on in these different approaches. Each one of you takes a completely different approach. Deborah and Ara, your papers are most closely aligned. Your paper, Ben, raised the question of the UN definition and do we need it? Set down in 1948, and have we moved beyond it? Explanatory models have increasingly moved away from it to theories of the phenomenon, be it Foucaultian notions of biopower, to anthropological, historical models of settler colonialism, to narrative paradigms that look at processes and structures that place genocide within a larger canvas of modernization and nation-state building and imperialism, decline and formation. This is the work I know you're well aware of Mark Levine and even your advisor, Ben Kiernan, whereas an element of political crisis management and globalizing pressures, sometimes as Dirk Moses, his work on East Pakistan, Pakistan shows, as an element of specific regional conflicts in the age of decolonization. Mathey, too, grapples with the historic specificity of the crimes and calls for the need to research case by case, tribe by tribe, how the Native Americans were destroyed from 5 million, the population reduced from 5 million to 250,000. The central tension in the debate, as long as the inquiry has been defined in terms of the convention, the focus on prosecution and punishment, has been on the one hand to establish a verdict of genocide or not genocide versus historically explain what actually happens without the trappings of an indictment. Are scholars of genocide seeking to prove a crime or explain it in all its complexities, facets, and contingencies? What is at stake, Mathey points out, is whether one's national history becomes a genocidal one. Are we naively or blindly perpetuating a nation-state model that is inherently genocidal, or at least a model that accommodates genocide? Is genocide to some degree unavoidable in our current world of power structures? Have we come to accept just genocides like just wars? As Mathey concludes, this vexing, disconcerting question can perhaps be answered by a more careful examination of the Native American catastrophe, massacre by massacre, region by region, tribe by tribe. Jennifer Dixon's original, very interesting work on states' narratives of dark past is an original exploration of rhetorical adaptations and the subversion of international norms, the hijacking and perversion of human rights speak to pursue human rights abuses, commit atrocities, and deny genocide. Remember Voltaire, who told us, those who make you believe absurdities can make you commit atrocities, or at least go along with them. Of course, states engaged in mass killing are clever enough to employ the same human rights language to divert attention from their misdeeds. Denial is the first stage of genocide, not its aftermath. And these rhetorical tricks are deliberately sinister and serve as a self-justification, legitimation. They are part and parcel of the ideology of genocide. All countries are prone to this wordplay, this speaking, this euphemistic speaking, this thinking of, in the Nazi case, the reference to protective custody in Nazi Germany was justifying the construction of Dachau. And today, even in the United States, when we speak about detention centers, illegal detention, incarceration in places like Adelanto, right here in San Bernardino County, this is also referred to as a form of protection, as kind of security speak. Dixon's interesting essay looks at rhetorical adaptation as a response to international norms and to a large degree as a resistance in the case of Turkey and its reaction to the Armenian genocide and international norms that are putting pressure on them to acknowledge it. Take Armenian genocide's Erdogan's recent approach. The words that he selected are meant to be diplomatic, even conciliatory, when in fact Dixon finds Erdogan's expression of condolences to Armenia in 2014 was not a progressive step. It was a move ostensibly compromising to the status quo, to keep the status quo, to support deniers. And this wordsmithing is like a wink and a nod to extremists and those who have the dominant ideology, even a mockery of the West and international norms. But these rhetorical adaptations, Dixon keenly points out, are not just for international consumption. Domestically, they fan the flames of animus between in and out groups, between the Armenian minority and Turkish majority. In this paradoxical age of increasing universalist and anti-Western human rights talk, how do states adapt to this paradigm, these pressures, as it were, of adapting to this human rights language and international norms? What happens when it doesn't fit? These norms don't fit with the dominant national narrative, and how do they respond to this? There's a kind of cognitive dissonance. And I was wondering, with Jennifer's paper in particular, if we move beyond those state actors, the presidential speeches, what about the intellectuals in Turkey? What about ordinary folks in Eastern Turkey who acknowledge the genocide? What about the internal dissonance? Is there any influential piece to that? In Lipstadt's paper on Holocaust denial, have the deniers invoked the genocide debate in the way that Madley has laid out for us and referred to the UN Convention and tried to put the Holocaust somehow to this definitional test of genocide in the way that Madley spells it out? Again, on the rhetorical adaptation, how does Dixon's paper on Turkey's tactics shed light on the research in Holocaust denial? Can we locate rhetorical adaptation at different levels below state leaders and beyond presidential speeches, as I said? Ara Sarafian's paper is the story of Ambassador Morgenthau Revisited, also part of the denial process, and Lowry's work as a key text. I look at Lowry as a kind of Irving figure in the denial movement there, trying to bring scholarly legitimacy and credibility to that movement. And these recent strategies of denial, from suppression and silencing to taking a more offensive approach and floating up of new paradigms to discredit key sources of evidence. I would be interested to hear Safran respond to Deborah's paper. To what extent are these tactics and strategies being employed in Turkey? Can we look at this as a kind of transfergeschichte, as a kind of transfer and interaction between these denier movements? And that's all I have to say. So thank you very much.